The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Philadelphia is probably one of the only fancy eastern seaboard cities that Clark Rockefeller didn't ply his trade in. Everywhere I've been until now, New York, Washington, Baltimore even, there was a Clark Rockefeller sighting or an episode that someone was able to tell me about. If anybody met him here, I'd be glad to know afterwards. Now, maybe it's because Philadelphians can see a phony in a way these people in other cities can't. In 1998, I was living in Montana. I had a ranch, 600 acres. I was in debt. I had a child on the way. I was between books, and a very strange proposition came my way. The local Humane Society had gotten in a dog, which was crippled and in a wheelchair, had been run over, and they'd put it up for adoption on the internet, the sort of 1998 version of the internet that no one really knew how it worked. And they got a phone call from a man in New York City, Clark Rockefeller, who said, "I would very much like to adopt this dog. I could really be its perfect owner. I have two problems. One, I don't have a driver's license, so I can't come all the way to Montana to get it. And number two, my private jet's in China with my wife." So the Humane Society was a little rattled by this contact and came to me and said, "Walter, you went to Princeton. You used to live in New York, right? Maybe you can talk to this Rockefeller fellow. You'll speak his language." I wasn't sure I could, but I got on the phone with him anyway. And here are a couple of highlights from our first phone call. He still wasn't finished trying to impress me, as though he thought it would burnish his credentials for the role of the setter's adoptive parent. He told me that he lived next door to Tony Bennett, whom he said he could hear rehearsing through the walls at night. He told me that he had degrees from Harvard and Yale, where he'd studied economics and mathematics. He told me that he could sing the words to any song that I might name to the tune of the theme from Gilligan's Island. And he demonstrated with a Cole Porter lyric. I think it was, "I say potato, you say potato," or however that goes. He told me that he'd learned from sources that Prince Charles and the Queen had murdered Diana with the help of a team of crack commandos. And he said that he knew from speaking with a close friend, the Admiral of the Navy's 7th Fleet, that the People's Republic of China and the United States had recently signed a secret treaty allowing the communists to invade Taiwan without opposition at their convenience. Now, he told me a couple of other things in this phone call. Number one, I asked him what he did for a living, and he said, "I'm a freelance central banker." And I heard the word freelance louder than I heard central banker. I said, "I didn't know that you could just sort of do that on an a la carte basis." And I asked him who he did it for, and he said, "Thailand." And I said, "Who else?" And he said, "That's classified." And looking back, I realized that any conversation you have with a person that involves reference to classified material the first time you meet should probably be a red flag. But red flags in those days with this particular guy were like slalom poles for me. I got around them somehow. I just cruised past them. Another thing he told me when we first spoke was that he'd never tasted Coca-Cola, and he asked me if I could describe its taste to him. Try doing that at home. I said it's very brown and sweet. Anyway, so I set off to take this dog to him. And it was 1,000 miles to Minnesota where my mom lived, which was going to be the halfway point. I decided that if I drove the dog personally in a truck, because the airlines wouldn't take it, it was too fragile. They didn't want to take on the liability. The Humane Society would get a big contribution, from a Rockefeller, and I would meet this incredible character who I could maybe write about someday. You know, I have my own motives. I got a couple of days into the drive, and I had a nervous breakdown. Number one, the dog could not brace itself. Its back end didn't work. So when we'd go around a corner, it would slam against the door or hit the glove compartment. It was also incontinent. In order to go to the bathroom, it had to be lifted off the ground. But if I lifted its back end off the ground, it went to the bathroom on me. And so I had to put it in its wheelchair, and then I'd have to leave it alone, give it its sort of modest distance, and then I'd have to take the wheelchair off, and this would happen every 20 minutes. It was 90 degrees out, and the air conditioning in my truck broke. It was July. I got to my mom's house a couple days later. My mom was a very, hard-nosed, common-sense Midwestern woman, a retired nurse. And this is what happened. Shelby, that's the name of the dog. Shelby soiled my mother's kitchen rug the moment I helped her roll into the house. My mother's place was a tribute to English cottages of the sort that Miss Marple might visit to solve a murder. All bookshelves and lamps and lace antimacassars, with so many welcoming nooks to sit and read in, so many helpful side tables and ottomans, that the question of how to best get comfortable there was a bit overwhelming. Just too much choice. On me, the house's effect was soporific, and happily so. The sleep I usually got there was soft, upholstered, deep, enveloping. It was the sleep of a prized and cared-for son, impossible to achieve in other settings. To benefit from this maternal service, though, required appreciative tidiness from me. No drinks without coasters, all throw pillows replaced. And Shelby's disgusting act when we arrived ruined the atmosphere, setting it on edge. "Out. That dog goes out," my mother said. She had me settle Shelby on the porch, under a bird feeder, hectic with wrens and chickadees. I folded her wheelchair and leaned it against a wall. "It's ugly, that thing. It upsets me," my mother said. She was a small woman with olive skin and complexion contrasting blue eyes, whose power was their ability to narrow decisively yet minutely, also instantly, leaving a person to wonder what had shifted, my mother's facial expression or the weather. Once she passed judgment on something, the issue was closed. There could be fighting about it, but no winning. When I came back inside after fussing with the chair, she made me wash my hands with ivory soap and gave me a fresh towel to dry them on. The towel went straight into the washing machine, along with the clothes that I had on. My other clothes were in the truck, but I was forbidden to bring my bag inside. My mother gave me a robe and made me shower and waited for me in her leather reading chair beside the stand where she displayed her dictionary and kept her curated kit of reading tools, her fringed leather bookmarks, her colored pencils, her ivory-handled magnifying glass. "I'm going to say this," she said when I sat down. "I can't. I'm sorry, Mom. It's not my dog." "I want you to put it down," she said. "I know why you might think that, but I just can't. This is absurd. It doesn't have a life. It can't even scratch itself, for heaven's sake. Who is this man, anyway? Clark? There's something wrong with him. Anyone who'd want that animal, there's something wrong with him. I'm telling you, which branch of the Rockefellers is he from? That's not the kind of thing we talk about. How old is he? My age? I don't know exactly. Who's his grandfather? Nelson? David? Lawrence?" My mother was a consumer of big biographies and knew her major lineages cold. Tudors, Plantagenets, Kennedys, Shrivers. The woman belonged on genealogical jeopardy. "Mom, I'm not up on that stuff," I said. "I need to sleep. I'm going to say something else to you." "Okay." I knew what was coming. Nothing. She'd go quiet. She'd let me imagine something, a trick of hers. She'd look at me, I'd look at her, and then I would make some excuse to look away. I hated it. I'd hated it since childhood. Maybe the new way to play things would be to say so. "I hate this, Mom," I said. "I hate this one." She let the silence chill and thicken. In the window behind her, the air was turning green, the color it gets in rural Minnesota when pelting hailstones are building inside black clouds and farmers are herding their animals indoors. Our small town was a strict, efficient, moral universe where even the elements collaborated to help make the points that needed to be made. "I need to bring her back inside," I said. "I'll only allow it if you put her down." "This is out of my hands," I said. "I made a promise." "Oh, fooey, Walt," my mother said. Well, I should have turned back there, and I didn't. Instead, I went on to New York. I had to fly the last part of the way. I pretended the dog could walk. I stuffed it into a crate, and the airline didn't notice. Got to New York. This man, Clark Rockefeller, told me I'd know him by his resemblance to David Hyde Pierce, the actor who played Niles on Frasier. In fact, that character was based on him, as was the show, he said. He had on a pink cap and a pink polo shirt. He met me at LaGuardia Airport. The dog came out of the baggage claim. It was breathing. He took it away. He said, "Tomorrow night, Sky Club, top of the MetLife building, meet you there, dinner." Whatever. So the next night I found myself at this dining room, in this private dining room atop this skyscraper, Midtown Manhattan, looking down on Rockefeller Center. At the end of the dinner, he patted his pocket and he said, "What do you say we take a tour of the family's place?" And he pointed at Rockefeller Center. You know, skyscrapers down there. And I said, "What?" And he says, "I have the key right here, you know, the master key." And I realized now in retrospect that he never showed me that key, just patted his pocket, promised he had it. For some reason, as the check came or whatever, as dinner ended, we didn't get around to the tour. But that key, until recently, I thought I had seen. And it's a tribute to his con artistry that he realized that the power of the imagination is power than the actual physical senses. The next day after that, he invited me over to his apartment where he showed me his art, which was $50 or $60 million, I estimated, worth of abstract expressionist masterpieces, Pollocks, Rothkos, de Koonings, so many that not all of them were hung. A lot of them were just leaning against the wall. And he had another dog, another Gordon Setter, and the dogs would sort of swipe their butts against the paintings as they walked by. And he would go along picking the hair off. And he'd say to me, "I think paint great art and pets should live comfortably together." And what did I think? Wow, to be so rich that you don't even care that your pets ruin your masterpiece artwork. Now that's a different breed of cat. Years went by, and I became friends with this guy. You're going to ask why, and I'm prepared to answer those questions. but in 2002... I went to visit him at his country house in Cornish, New Hampshire. For years, he'd been asking me to come visit him. He'd left New York by now. He said he was sick of the city. He'd had a nervous breakdown. His freelance central banking business had sort of flopped. Not because he'd done anything wrong, but because Thailand wouldn't listen to him. So he had kept inviting me, and finally he baited the hook with something I couldn't resist. He said, "If you come up to Cornish and stay the weekend, we'll go over to Jerry's house next door, Jerry Salinger, J.D. Salinger." Now, as a writer, I couldn't resist that. And I knew that J.D. Salinger indeed lived in this little village in New Hampshire, and it wasn't impossible that he and Clark did know each other. Also, Clark said he'd been writing novels, and he'd been telling me this for years. He'd written some novels, and he wanted me to help edit them, and he would pay me handsomely for this favor, he said. So he hoped we'd discuss that. I got up there. He lived in this dilapidated old mansion. It was under renovation. It was up on jacks. There were windows missing. The bed was on the floor on this sort of low platform. It was disconcerting. We went out to dinner the first night. He didn't drive, of course, so we drove. He told me I should order anything I wanted. I did. When we got to dessert, he said, you know, let's have dessert. And I said, of course, yeah, we had dessert. And then he patted his pocket again and said, oh, he forgot his wallet. So as we drove back that night, I thought, I'm done with this friendship. And I was going to leave early in the morning, get out of the house, maybe before he woke up, leave a note. But when I woke up, there he was in the door, and he said, what do you say we go up to Dartmouth and tour my aunt's art museum? He told me that his aunt had given Dartmouth its art museum, and that even though it wasn't open on a Sunday morning, we'd be able to go in because of his family connections. And indeed, when we got there, the guard let us right in. We had a private tour. Afterwards, we sat out on a sidewalk and had breakfast. And I, as I say, despite the art museum tour, was disgusted with him by then. This is how it went. We sat at a tippy table on the sidewalk and ordered tea and coffee, juice and pastries. I vowed to myself to make him pay, though maybe it would be better to split the check. Dignity lay in holding up one's end of things. Or should I shame him by covering the whole thing? Of course, it wouldn't shame him, though it ought to, but maybe beholding further shamelessness would finally force me to act, not merely stew. Tourists went by in their clashing tourist outfits, grumpy with one another, dulled by leisure. I had to get back to work. I couldn't wait. Every moment with Clark was a horrendous waste. I needed an epitaph for him, and it was this. He was a waste and a waster and on purpose. To think too hard about what his purpose might be would only be a further waste. Did you know I consider you my best friend? He said. It startled me, his perfect timing. I'd been about to throw coffee in his face. I'll tell you why, he said. You're the only person in my life who doesn't want something from me, who isn't envious. I can't be myself with most persons. It's a curse. With you, though, I'm relaxed and comfortable. I'm grateful for this. What a visit. It's been splendid. Thank you, I said. I felt cornered by his effusion. I tore a corner off my pastry and dunked it in my coffee, noticing Clark's expression as I did so. He looked displeased, but determined not to show it. I dunked things. He didn't. We came from different worlds. Mine no longer embarrassed me, however, which meant that his was losing power. I felt sure that he sensed this, and I was curious about what he'd do to try to gain it back. He confessed. He invited me deep into his sadness, pinning me under its melancholy flow. His family was atrocious. His uncles and aunts who'd stood in for his dead parents had shooed him along from home to home. His sister, a lunatic, was rotting in some hospital. Unclear to me was whether he missed her or whether her incarceration suited him. I seemed to recall that he'd portrayed her once as something of a burden. He described himself as a wandering, lost soul who had been educated but never nurtured, who had settled for paid-for knowledge as a substitute for priceless affection. The membranes surrounding his light blue eyes turned pink. The wings of his nostrils subtly flared and trembled. People passed by our table with no idea that a Rockefeller was agonizing nearby, pouring out his troubles to a mere kern. America, I remember thinking. It muddles all of us up together in such strange ways. The melting pot was at full boil. Tell me about these novels you've been writing. I asked this, I told myself, to play for time, not because I was truly curious. I managed to stay inwardly remote, but my tone was solicitous. If I lured him back into pleasant conversation, I thought, he'd eventually try to dominate it, angering me afresh. I needed fresh anger. He'd sucked it out of me. I needed fresh pain to send me running. What? He said. Your books, your novels, what are they about? Oh, those, he said. They're homages. They're reworkings. Amusing things to write, but I can't claim they're original. Well, literature's never original, I said. I'd got this idea at Princeton, which had borrowed it from Yale, from Harold Bloom, a professor there. His book was called The Anxiety of Influence. It was one of those books whose title tells it all, and that had allowed me to skim it in good conscience. My novels are adaptations of memorable episodes from Star Trek, the TV series, Clark said. Star Trek. It helped ground me to speak the words, and I hoped it disguised my flabbergastedness. The rights, I said, have you obtained the rights? If you want to exploit another trademarked property, I was channeling my lawyer father's vocabulary, grateful for the cover it provided. You first have to secure the rights to do so. Oh, I'm sure that the person who owns them will sell them to me. You know, Walter, everything is available for a price. Right, I said, that's true. I was still regrouping. I was starting to think the process might take a while. And maybe I should consider drawing it out, to tease him and to waste his time for a change. So each novel, each book is one episode, he said. Interesting. I meant the opposite. I repeated the word to emphasize this fact, in case he thought that I was speaking sincerely, not slyly cutting him. Interesting. It was a word very seldom spoken in earnest when responding to book descriptions, book ideas. But did he know this? It was also a word that, if spoken three times, turned back into a compliment, I feared. I didn't say it again. I tried to seem far away instead, and drifting further by the millisecond, back to my life, to Montana, beyond his reach. And truly, I was almost there. All I had to do first was give him a ride back home. Star Trek The Next Generation, he explained. You're probably thinking of the original series. Are you? I suspect you are. The original series never grabbed me. I found it terribly inferior. I much preferred the sequel. What I found about psychopaths, and he turned out to be one, is that they always prefer the sequel, being copies themselves. In 1985, this fellow who I had befriended and living under another name, Christopher Chichester, 13th Baronet of England, was living outside of Los Angeles in a very fancy suburb called San Marino, and he acquired his love of Star Trek there by the very strangest route imaginable. And this is the last little bit I'll read. Sort of the origins of that Star Trek obsession of his. The Baronet didn't deign to speak to everyone. One person he ignored by most accounts was geeky John Sohus, then in his mid-20s. John, who lived with his mother in the main house, the Baronet lived in a guest house of this old woman's mansion. John, who lived with his mother in the main house, was diabetic and adopted. He played Dungeons and Dragons. He loved Tolkien. He liked to dress in Star Trek uniforms. He knew how to program an Apple II computer back when such knowledge was not a route to millions, but a pursuit whose prestige among his peer group lay somewhere between thumb-sucking and juggling. John was a little guy. His girlfriend, Linda, who worked in a San Fernando Valley fantasy bookstore, Dangerous Visions, had a good 6 inches and 50 pounds on him. Her hobby was painting unicorns and centaurs. She hoped to make a career of it someday. For their wedding, the couple threw a costume party. One guest was a robot, another a horned demon, and held it on a doubly spooky date, Halloween, 1984. A few months later, the prosecution charged the film student who wasn't enrolled in film school and didn't appear to be flourishing in Hollywood despite his supposed connection to top directors, bashed in John's skull with 3 blows from a blunt object and stabbed him repeatedly in the back and arms with something razor-like and piercing. No motive for the crime was given in court. California law does not require one. But it may have involved a modest inheritance destined for John that Chichester coveted. Detectives would later interview a woman from whom he extracted, the woman said, a $40,000 finder's fee for her right to nurse an ailing Didi who felt abandoned by her missing son. In 1987, with John still gone, Didi put the woman in her will and perished soon afterwards while in her care. Chichester showed up to split the take, but there wasn't much left, the woman told police, and she sent him away unsatisfied. The story was inadmissible in court because the night before the woman was set to be formally deposed, she died. So Chichester may have killed John Sohus for nothing. He may also have done the following for nothing. Cut the body up into three sections, possibly with an electric chainsaw he borrowed from a neighbor around this time. Placed the head inside two plastic shopping bags, both of them from college bookstores, one at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, the other at USC. Wrapped the hands in plastic grocery bags, wound the torso in plastic sheets, dug a 3-foot deep pit in the backyard, stuffed at least a portion of the remains into a fiberglass drum and buried them. Wiped up the blood in the guest house and burned the carpet. Returned the chainsaw. Arranged to have forwarded from France a series of postcards written either by Linda or by a forger familiar with her handwriting, possibly the baronet himself, informing her mother-in-law and several friends that she and John were enjoying a holiday in France. But Linda wasn't in Europe. She was gone. She never returned to work at Dangerous Visions. She never answered the phone calls from the man who'd bought a couple of her paintings, her first sale. And she never drove out to Phoenix with her best friend for the big science fiction and fantasy convention that they'd been planning to attend. She also missed the little garden party that Chichester organized a few months later, setting up a table in the backyard next to the dirt mound atop her husband's grave and playing a game of Trivial Pursuit. Linda, whose new white Nissan pickup truck Chichester then drove back to the East Coast, where all the dog-loving freelance central bankers live. Thank you. So I'm happy to take questions, and I hope you have some. Otherwise, I didn't do my job.
Hi, Walt. How you doing?
Good.
Obviously, he had some money that he got from somewhere.
Yeah.
You mentioned the paintings. Did it come out where how he accumulated so much wealth? Did he actually own the house in New Hampshire that he took you to?
Well, first of all, everything about him turned out to be fake, including the paintings. Though they were very good copies, they were worthless. While I was there at his house looking at them, a restorer from the Museum of Modern Art came in to clean them. I've never been sure if it was an actor or an actual employee. So the paintings were worthless. The house cost him $600,000. It was a sort of famous estate of a well-known Judge Learned Hand. He was never a Supreme Court justice, but It had more history than it did insulation, let's put it that way. So he was living with a grandeur that wasn't quite what it appeared, but he was getting all his money from his wife. See, what's amazing about this guy is that in 1985, after he fled the scene of this murder, the wife has never been found. The husband was found 9 years later, buried in the yard when a swimming pool excavator came to do his job. But at the time, it just seemed they'd gone missing, and he fled the scene, taking their pickup truck, moved back to Connecticut, and started a new pose as a man named Christopher Crowe, producer of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the sequel to the original Alfred Hitchcock Presents. In any case, in 1994, he married a woman in New York. He had now morphed into Clark Rockefeller. And she was a Harvard MBA on her way up at McKinsey Corporation, the sort of management consultant. And at the peak of her earning while married to him, she was making a couple of $1 million a year. And they showed at trial these checkbooks they'd found in a storage locker of his, empty checkbooks which she'd signed you know, the signature line on. So he had blank checks from her. He basically took her total income and used it for his needs. But because he was a fugitive, he couldn't have a driver's license. He couldn't open a bank account, file a tax return. It turned out that he wasn't even married to Sandy. He'd finessed that by becoming a Quaker right before they got married. And it turns out that Quaker wedding services, maybe some of you are Quakers, don't have officiants. So he was able to tell her that, you know, they were legally married when they just sort of had this staged ceremony that he'd... in any case, it all came from a woman, you know.
And to Shelby.
Well, that you have to read the book for. You see, you know, one, I was a babe in the woods. For all my thoughts that I was going to maybe take advantage of him by making him a character in a book someday, as soon as I met him, I thought, he's a braggart, and he's a little bit of what my mom would call a pest, and he's very insecure, and he's kind of annoying, but he's a great storyteller, and he's one of a kind, and, you know, I don't have to live with him, so I can take him or leave him, and I found him quite amusing in a lot of ways. But what I didn't know was that that dog delivery was part of a big con that he was running that I didn't understand at all. And really, to explain it, I had to write the whole book. But I'll tell you this, it's not unknown, and it's actually common among sociopaths, that they use animals and a very sort of overt love of animals to cover their lack of empathy, to camouflage themselves. So imagine this guy walking a dog in a wheelchair every day in Central Park, which he did. I mean, he looked almost like a human being. Rather than, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer in a bow tie. So, you know, in the same way that Ted Bundy wore a cast on his arm to sort of gain sympathy and you know, look like a wounded bird, Clark Rockefeller used a crippled dog.
At what point did it sort of the things become clear? And you realize that he's a true psychopath and maybe a dangerous one. And sort of what was that like for you?
Well, you know, I'll tell you exactly what happened. He was, in 2008, arrested for kidnapping his daughter from a custody hearing in Boston. He'd lost he'd lost his daughter and he'd lost his marriage. He decided to get even by kidnapping her. And a nationwide Amber Alert went out. And I'd known in the previous year that he was starting to get very upset about this split from his wife and this loss of Snooks, his little girl. And I turned on the news in August 2008, nationwide Amber Alert, Clark Rockefeller wanted for kidnapping. And then a few days later, the Rockefellers come out and say, he's not one of us. We don't know who this man is. And I thought, you cowards, you know, throwing one of your own under the bus just because he brings a little scandal on the family name. And I actually got my girlfriend, who is a journalist, to post those thoughts on Facebook, because I wasn't on Facebook yet. Anyway, a few weeks after that, it came out that he was a suspect in this murder from 1985. And in the descriptions of the crime, it said, then calling himself Baronet Christopher Chichester and living in the guest house of Didi Sohus, you know, he is thought to have committed these murders. And I flashed back to a couple of months after I'd met him, and he called me while I was in Montana, and he said, Walter, I'm getting tired of New York. I'd love to come out and stay in Montana. Why don't I come and stay at your place? And I said, well, you know, I've got a baby on the way, and there's not much room in the house. And he said, well, do you have a guest house? You know, a little place. And I said, yes. And he said, well, perfect. I used to live in a guest house in California, and I've never been happier in all my life. At that moment, remembering that detail, I knew that he was guilty of this murder. And it was as though a trapdoor opened under this stage, and I fell through into an aquarium full of pink water and fish. I mean, the whole world changed color and texture, and I thought, you know, you are the world's biggest fool, Walter. I mean, you're not any a bigger fool than his wife, and then the investment banks that hired him to sell bonds, even though he had no qualifications, and people at the Indian River Yacht Club or whatever in Greenwich, Connecticut, who let him join, even though he wasn't who he said he was. Everybody who'd known this guy was a fool. He had made a career of turning people into fools, of sort of hacking the social contract so that your politeness, your goodwill, your unwillingness to have conflict and so on could be manipulated for his end. But, you know, that moment of revelation really was a kind of a psychological trauma, you know. It was like finding out that your wife has another family across the street, you know, or something.
What do you think his motivation was in befriending you? What did he think he was going to get out of that relationship?
Yeah, I've got a couple theories on that. And I, at the trial, somebody who was his neighbor in New Hampshire got up to testify, and the prosecution said, "What, you know, what did he like to talk about?" And he said, "Well, one thing he liked to talk about was his ranch in Montana." I realized that this was Clark's MO. He would take friends who had different experiences, and he'd pump them for information. And these friends didn't know each other. And then he'd go around the circle to the next one and use stories that this one had told him and make them sound like they were part of his own biography to the next one. In other words, in some ways, he used everybody to fill out his own biography with interesting tales. I was convenient because I didn't live in the city. I wasn't going to bump into somebody else he knew. We weren't going to compare notes. I was very isolated and compartmentalized. But also, he wanted to be a writer. I mean, a lot of this book takes place after the trial, when I resume my relationship with him in prison. And I found out he was writing, or had completed, in pencil, like a 2-inch pencil stub that they give you in prison, a 1,500-page novel about European history that he wanted me to read. And like most art created by psychopaths, it was perfectly executed and absolutely empty of emotion. He sent me a sonnet from prison called German Electoral Sonnet Number 2. It was a plea for the Nazi Party to be included in German presidential elections. That's the kind of thing he writes lyric poetry about. So I think he wanted to be friends with the writer. I think he wanted to have a ranch in Montana. I think he also subconsciously, he'd created his masterpiece with this murder. This was you'll see in the book, an incredibly devious, highly planned murder in which he got the victims to go around telling people weeks before they died that they would be going on a secret mission and not to miss them. Don't worry about us. They didn't know what they were doing. They were creating a cover for their own deaths. That's how sick this guy was. And he did indeed play a game of Trivial Pursuit with his friends and iced tea and sort of festive snacks next to the grave of his victim. When one of the players looked and saw the dirt mound, she remembered, he said, "Well, we've had plumbing problems in the yard." So you cannot fathom the level of calculation that went into this. I think someday he figured it might all come out, and maybe he wanted somebody who'd be there to write about him. He asked me in jail if I'd write his biography. He told me he'd tell me the truth about everything. But by that time, I knew that he'd never once told me the truth, and he never would.
So what does he think of your book?
Well, judging by the one-star pseudonymous reviews he's given it on Amazon, which are this is exactly what I think. I can almost quote it. I expected a book about the fascinating manipulator and con man who called himself Clark Rockefeller, but instead got one about the neurotic and boring writer Walter Kern. One star. Now, the reason I know that it's him is because he is one of those devious sort of Dostoevskian characters who is always encoding his own messages. So Christopher Corcoran, that particular one was signed. He always used the initials CC, Chris Crow, Chris Chichester, etc. I told somebody that's so that he could keep using his monogrammed shirts, and they said, no, I think it's because he likes the pun. And I said, what's the pun? Carbon copy. In any case, so I think he loves that the book is out there, and he just doesn't think it includes enough of him on every page.
Walter, how does one like emerge as a Rockefeller? I mean, do you go undercover for? I think you described. You said he was married to someone.
Yeah.
So where was she with him suddenly becoming Clark Rockefeller?
Well, okay, so here's the murder trial was interesting because the murder happened back in 1985. A lot of the witnesses were dead. The remains had been lost by the coroner. There were just photographs of them. So a lot of the testimony at the trial was by people who'd known him since, who could speak to the fact that he seemed to be evading capture. Portraying him as somebody who is running from something was the essence of the prosecution's case, in other words. So there was very specific testimony about how he built these aliases and these alternate persona. In the case of Clark Rockefeller, here's how he did it. He simply joined a very fancy Episcopal church in Manhattan. Wherever he went, he always joined the nicest Episcopal church until suddenly he decided to be a Quaker that one time. In fact, so much was he wedded to this Quaker pose that after he was caught and accused of murder, he said he couldn't have committed it, and it wouldn't have been logical for him to commit it because he was a pacifist. That was the strangest defense I've ever heard. It can't be me. I'm a well-known pacifist. Anyway, Clark Rockefeller went to this church, started introducing himself around, and it was that easy. No one called him on it. He met his wife as a Rockefeller, and she never knew him by anything else until in 2006 she did a Google search of the woman he'd said was his mother, who he said was dead. He said he was the son of a Hollywood actress who had died a long time ago. And the wife's father actually did a Google search and saw that this woman was still alive. And then the whole house of cards came down. But it was as simple as introducing himself, dressing. He used the official preppy handbook, I'm convinced, which came out in the year he... See, he was a German kid who came at 17 to Connecticut and lived in a house of Americans and started polishing his act. And there was no, besides the art, and I'm sure he printed up some business cards and, you know, had some letterhead, there was no real problem pretending to be a Rockefeller. It's shocking, but we don't go around asking for verification with each other. We have to live with trust and take each other on faith. We do it less now, it seems. You know, the biggest question I get is, why didn't you just Google this guy? But I'd known him for years by the time people started doing that, and it didn't compute that he wasn't who he said he was. I'd gone to private clubs in New York where, Mr. Rockefeller, let me take your coat. I'd seen his art. I'd done all these things that seemed to prove him to be authentic. That wasn't my question. My question was, why did I hang out with somebody who was so annoying? Anyway.
Do you know anything about his childhood, family of origin, any of his earliest history?
Yeah. I call that question number three because what everybody wants to know, and I did too, was what happened to make him this terrible a man? We've come to the conclusion in this society that if you do evil or terrible things, something terrible must have been done to you at some point. Well, my answer is nothing all that bad ever happened to Clark Rockefeller. If he was born evil, I wouldn't be surprised. When he was a kid, he used to go up to people and say, "Look what I have," and he'd hold his hand up to their face, and they'd look down, and then he'd blow pepper into their eyes. He'd go out at night and take the road signs in his little village in Bavaria, in Germany, and put them on different posts so that people would drive around lost. When he was convicted of kidnapping, or when he was put on trial for kidnapping his daughter, his lawyers convinced him to plead insane. And so they hired a very fancy TV psychiatrist named Dr. Keith Ablow, who's on Fox News doing psychiatric analyses of politicians, I guess, to check into his past and, you know, substantiate the fact that something had driven him crazy. And there was nothing. His mother in Germany sounds a little bit like Blanche DuBois, you know, a small town woman who maybe had some gentleman callers. The father was a frustrated artist who went to an art academy but ended up painting houses. Maybe it wasn't the warmest family, but, you know, then again, it was Germany. So there's really no evidence that some trauma launched him on this life. And I think that's really scary. One thing I've found in this book is that everybody wants a rosebud for this guy, a moment when he lost something, a moment when he had true feeling. Maybe it was for his daughter. Maybe it was for his dogs. I'll tell you, if you'll read the book, you'll find out that you can look and look and look and dig and dig and dig for the humanity in this person, and you will never get there.
I'm just wondering how you were able to recuperate.
Who says I have?
I'm sure it was therapeutic in a way to get it down on paper and work through. But has it changed your perspective on trusting people that you meet? I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, I don't trust anyone anymore. Why should I really? I mean, people say, "Oh, we live in the age of Google. This wouldn't be possible. You can check on everybody." I said, yeah, we also live in the age of Facebook and Twitter, in which, you know, half the people we think we know may not even be human. The immediate effect, I remember, was this. About a month after it happened, a plumber who I actually knew asked if he could have a key to my house while I was on vacation. He'd go in and do some work while I was gone. There was no way I was giving it to him. I was also divorced by this time, and something called Match.com was starting. And I decided I might try online dating. And I remember going on the website and seeing these people's pictures and their description of who they were. And I thought, there's no way to verify any of this. I can't do this. So really, for the whole time since, I've been a much warier person. Now my defense is I grew up in a town of 500 in rural Minnesota, where you expected strangers to give you candy, and they expected you to get into their car, because everybody was, you know, it was like Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. And so I didn't have the immunity, I think, that some people might growing up in a city. But ruined for a short time my ability to sort of trust anybody, and it probably compromised forever my ability to trust people who talk about having classified information.
I'm curious about the art that you saw.
Yeah.
Were these replications of actual Rothkos that we would recognize, or were they sort of like de Koonings and Rothkos?
This is another thing that I get into in the book. I'll sum it up. I kind of went down the rabbit hole about the paintings, and it's in the book. You see, at the same time Clark was Clark Rockefeller, there was a place called the Knoedler Gallery in New York City that was the biggest dealer in this abstract expressionist art. And about the time Clark was arrested, trying to flee with his daughter, and probably flee the country, this gallery, it was revealed, had been selling on the world market fake Rothkos, fake de Koonigs, fake Pollocks. In other words, the entire world market in abstract expressionist art at the time Clark Rockefeller was counterfeit. He's known to have gone to that gallery. He's known to have known its director. He told me in jail that he was part of this fraud. Now, this is a hundreds of million dollar fraud that has been busted by the FBI. The counterfeiter of these paintings was revealed to be a Chinese guy in Queens who fled last year. It's all in the series of New York Times stories. Somehow I believe Clark to be involved with this. These were paintings that weren't copies of Rothko's that existed, but ones that would have fit into his career if you knew a lot about his career and, you know, saw the development of his style. They might have slotted in somewhere. So they were not only good fakes in the sense that they were executed well, they were convincing works in these various artists' oeuvres. I really can't do that word. So a lot of thought went into this. He was involved at some level in this fraud, I'm convinced. But and he set me on this notion, knowing that as a writer and a journalist, I'd start investigating it and driving myself crazy, and I finally had to back off it. But that's my best guess.
Yeah, why didn't you cover what happened to Shelby?
Well, I do cover it. As I say in the book, he had this dog for a general reason, which was to gain sympathy for himself as a conversation starter. Many very tender-hearted young women in Central Park oohed and awed over the man who would take care of this dog. But he also had a specific reason involving some people who he wanted something from, who happened to be dog lovers. And with Clark, you never knew what part of the puzzle you played. That was one of the most shocking things. I wrote this book for everybody who's ever been deceived. If in romance, business, politics, or whatever, we've all been fooled. If you're an American, you've been fooled. They called it the Iraq War. And there was a lot of weapons of mass destruction under the ground that were a lot like that key in Clark Rockefeller's pocket. We were sure they were there, but we never quite saw them. I'm hoping that this isn't just a healing book for me or a warning for me to be more alert next time. I'm hoping that all of us, when we hear stories that are too good to be true or so amusing we don't want to know whether they're true, we step back. Maybe you already do that, but I didn't. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.